From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a New York doctor tests positive for Ebola. Should the international community focus on source nations of Ebola?
I don't think there's any choice. This is a security threat to West Africa and beyond.
Canada's parliament reflects after Wednesday's shooting. And chilly water is no deterrent to growing numbers of wild swimmers. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. A New York City doctor who recently treated Ebola victims in Guinea has become the first person in the U.S. city to be diagnosed with the virus. Mayor Bill de Blasio confirmed the case late Thursday, saying Dr. Craig Spencer has been placed in isolation and there is no cause for alarm. Spencer on Thursday notified the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, where he worked, that he had a high fever and was nauseous, two symptoms of Ebola. Officials are looking for anyone who may have had contact with Spencer. He would be the fourth person diagnosed with Ebola on U.S. soil. Andrew Cuomo is the governor of New York. He spoke today with NBC Television's Matt Lauer.
Once Dr. Spencer identified himself, did officials here do what they needed to do in a timely fashion and exercising the proper protocols? Are you confident in that?
As confident as one can be, Matt. You know, with you're right. This is a situation that we hoped wouldn't happen, but we expected that it would. It is New York. People come through here. We also had the advantage here of notice. Dallas really had no notice. We all watched what happened in Dallas. So we have been preparing literally for weeks on a coordinated effort plan between New York City, New York State, federal government, CDC. We had just done a training with 5,000 healthcare workers. A healthcare union has been fantastic. And this was a doctor. So the doctor was familiar with the disease. And again, this is not like the flu. It's not airborne. It's not from people sneezing. The person has to be symptomatic, and it's basically transferred through bodily fluids.
Yeah, but you say
so
it's a doctor who was familiar with the disease.
Obviously felt he wasn't symptomatic.
Well, if you're so familiar with the disease, you know you've been treating Ebola patients in Guinea, you come back to this country, do you ride the subways? Do you take an Uber car? Do you go to a bowling alley? Do you think Dr. Spencer acted responsibly?
Look, I'm not a doctor, Matt, but the flip side of what you just said is if you're a doctor, you know you're not contagious until you're symptomatic. This is a doctor who was taking his temperature twice a day and obviously concluded that he was not symptomatic, and that's why he went out, still in a limited way. He went bowling with two friends. He was with his fiance, and he took the subway. But he obviously felt he wasn't symptomatic. He knew that was the only time it was contagious. As soon as he had a fever, he presented himself to the hospital. All the procedures there on were exactly according to the book. The first responders did a magnificent job. The healthcare workers did a magnificent job. So everything has happened the way it should happen since then. We've been in contact with the federal officials. President Obama called last night. Ron Klain, the new Ebola czar. Sylvia Burwell, head of Health and Human Services. So everything worked the way it should. And our hope and our belief is that the doctor who was familiar,
right,
wasn't symptomatic. That's why he left the house and wasn't contagious when he's not symptomatic.
Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York, speaking on NBC's Today Show. There was some good news today. Former infected nurse Nina Pham has been released from the National Institutes of Health after being declared Ebola-free. She met briefly today with the news media gathered at NIH.
I feel fortunate and blessed to be standing here today. I would first and foremost like to thank God, my family, and friends. Throughout this ordeal, I have put my trust in God and my medical team. I am on my way back to recovery, even as I reflect on how many others have not been so fortunate. Of course, I am so incredibly thankful for everyone involved in my care from the moment I became ill and was admitted to Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, Dallas, up to today, my discharge from the Clinical Research Center of NIH. I would especially like to thank Dr. Kent Brantley for his selfless act of donating plasma to me. As a nurse, I have a special appreciation for the care I've received from so many people, not just doctors and nurses, but the entire support team. I believe in the power of prayer because I know so many people all over the world have been praying for me. I do not know how I can ever thank you, everyone, enough for their prayers and their expressions of concern, hope, and love. I join you in prayer now for the recovery of others, including my colleague and friend, Amber Vinson, and Dr. Craig Spencer. I hope that people understand that this illness and this whole experience has been very stressful and challenging for me and for my family. Although I no longer have Ebola, I know that it may be a while before I have my strength back. So with gratitude and respect for everyone's concern, I ask for my privacy and for my family's privacy to be respected as I return to Texas and try to get back to a normal life and reunite with my dog, Bentley. Thank you, everyone.
Former Ebola patient Nina Pham speaking at NIH. The United States is forming medical teams that will rush to any part of the country where a new Ebola case is suspected. The Centers for Disease Control Ebola Response Teams, or CERTs for short, are made up of experts who are specially trained to diagnose and treat Ebola. Preparatory teams called Facility Assessment and Support Teams, or FASS, will check hospitals that have volunteered to treat Ebola patients to make sure they can handle an Ebola case. VOA's Latika Hoke has details.
Each rapid response team consists of about 20 members who will be ready to depart within hours to any part of the United States where a patient has been diagnosed with Ebola or is highly suspected of infection.
Well, the rapid response teams are meant to assist hospitals that see suspect Ebola patients. The response teams consist of specialists in infection control, clinical medicine, Ebola outbreak investigation, communications, and a variety of other disciplines, including laboratory.
President Barack Obama ordered the formation of specialized teams after the first Ebola case diagnosed in the United States showed that most hospitals are not prepared to handle the virus. The patient who arrived from Liberia was treated at a hospital in Dallas, Texas, but died on October 8th after infecting two nurses who took care of him. The case caused fear that Ebola may spread in the United States, and many Americans have accused health officials of not being prepared to deal with the virus. Mr. Obama said rapid response teams will ensure that proper procedures are applied in all suspected Ebola cases.
If we do these protocols properly, if we follow the steps, if we get the information out, then the likelihood of widespread Ebola outbreaks in this country are very, very low.
The president sought to allay the fears that the deadly virus would spread in the United States. The decision to deploy an Ebola response team will ultimately be made by the CDC director at the request of a hospital or clinic that may need it.
Our emergency operations center has been activated. I think we're in our 106th day of our activation. So the decision to deploy a CDC Ebola response team would lie with the incident management structure. Now, our emergency operations center is our director's operations center. So, of course, all decisions ultimately sit with Dr. Frieden.
Team members are drawn from a list of about 100 health workers scattered across the country. Three FAST teams already have been sent out to New York, Chicago, and Washington. No CERT teams have been deployed yet, but the first group of 20 is on standby with their bags packed. Latissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Dr. J. Stephen Morrison is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of West Africa's Galloping Ebola Crisis. We asked him how prepared for the spread of Ebola are the major world powers.
The major powers in the world are all scrambling to prepare themselves for dealing with Ebola. It was not until very recently that they had to countenance the very real possibility that Ebola might be landing on their shores. And so the preparations that are needed in terms of the screening, the contact tracing on cases, the infection control procedures, the protective gear that people need to wear, the public communications, all of the key interventions that need to be brought into force, the protocols, the training, the handling of contaminated waste. Those are things that are complicated, that require intensified training and practice. And I don't think that most of the major powers have gone through the full drill, the full spectrum of exercises that are needed, and yet they realize this is a very real threat now with the increased importation of cases of Ebola into Europe and North America and elsewhere.
If the world powers are scrambling, what does that mean for the developing world?
The developing world, the countries that are in greatest peril at the moment are those that, other than those that are fighting this, the Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea complex of three countries that are beset by this runaway epidemic. The states that are at greatest risks are those that are in the immediate neighborhood, and those are Senegal, Nigeria, Ghana, Mali, and others. They are ones where, and Cote d'Ivoire, these are countries where there's quite a bit of traffic coming by foot, by road, by air, by sea, and Senegal and Nigeria have both handled cases, have been tested in their ability to manage and respond to the entry of contagious and highly symptomatic individuals with Ebola, infected with Ebola. Nigeria mobilized on a considerable scale. Senegal did the same. They've proven themselves able to bring them under control and after a period of time to be ruled free of Ebola. They're not out of the woods in the sense that they still remain vulnerable. As the epidemic in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea continues to mushroom, the numbers of cases are expanding exponentially. Every 20 days, the epidemic is doubling. It's expected there'll be 10,000 new cases per week in December, and there are projections that are rather staggering projections as to what the aggregate number of cases may look like when we get into the new year, upwards of 1.4 million. As that human base increases, of course, the risk increases that there'll be increased export of cases into the surrounding region and beyond.
Some people suggest that Ebola should be attacked at its source, that the international community should pour money into these nations where the Ebola virus seems to be affecting the most people. Do you agree with that?
I don't think there's any choice. This is a security threat to West Africa and beyond. The UN Security Council has passed a motion declaring that. Statements have been made by many world leaders, including President Obama, affirming this, that this is a public health crisis that has transmuted into a major global security threat. It has to be, there is no choice on ethical and on security grounds that those countries with the capacity to lead, like the United States, the British, and others, need to step forward and make major commitments. What we've seen in the last period is major commitments coming from several countries. The United States has been the boldest and the most dramatic in the commitment of now upwards of 4,000 U.S. troops, up to $1 billion in military assistance, over $350 million in civilian agency assistance, predominantly directed towards Liberia. The British are making a very dramatic commitment into Sierra Leone, 750 troops, £300 million of commitment into Sierra Leone. The French are doing something similar in Guinea. The World Bank has responded with over $400 million in emergency facilities. IMF is promising to be supportive. The EU has come in with 130 million euros in support. But the UN operation, which is meant to be to grow into being a multilateral coordinated effort for all three of the countries and some of the neighboring countries if they face infections. The UN mission for emergency Ebola response, UNMEER, which is basing itself out of Accra, Ghana, is struggling to get adequate commitments and pledges. There is a struggle. There are gaps. There's the need to do a lot more. We have to move on a very large scale and very quickly.
Dr. J. Stephen Morrison, Senior Vice President and Director of the CICE Global Health Policy Center. Monday, we'll speak with him about locking down borders and preventing flights out of the hardest-hit Ebola nations. European leaders agreed today to a $1 billion funding boost for the fight against Ebola in West Africa as they wrapped up a summit marked by a key agreement over climate change and divisions on financial issues. Lisa Bryant has details from Paris.
The new European Union assistance for the Ebola fight, 1 billion euros, or about $1.27 billion, amounts to a victory for British Prime Minister David Cameron, who has been pushing the bloc to do more to respond to the deadly outbreak. As he told reporters afterwards, he got what he wanted at the summit.
In facing Ebola, we are facing one of the worst public health emergencies in a generation. And I've been absolutely determined that Britain, with other countries, will lead the way in dealing with this. Dealing with it because there is a massive crisis in West Africa, and we should feel some moral obligation as a wealthy country to help. But also dealing with it because it directly threatens our national interest and our people in the United Kingdom. And that is why we have taken such a leading role.
European Union leaders also appointed a coordinator of the EU's Ebola response amid growing alarm at the virus's impact as Mali and New York reported their first confirmed cases. A highlight of the two-day summit was a landmark climate change agreement. European Union President Herman Van Rompuy hailed the deal that leaders had reached after hours of negotiations and divisions.
It was not easy, not at all, but we managed to reach a fair decision. It sets Europe on an ambitious yet cost-effective climate and energy path. Climate change is one of the biggest challenges of mankind. Ultimately, this is about survival. It is the example of a long-term policy.
Under the pact, EU leaders are committed to cutting greenhouse gas emissions to 40% of their 1990 levels by 2030. They also agreed on 27% targets for cutting energy consumption and increasing the share of renewables in the overall energy mix. But environmental groups have expressed disappointment in the deal, particularly since both renewable energy and energy efficiency targets for countries are non-binding. The summit was also marked by sharp divisions over how to jumpstart sluggish economies of the 18-member Eurozone. And Prime Minister Cameron expressed fury at a demand for Britain to pay an extra $2.7 billion to the EU by December 1st because the British economy has been performing better than those of its European partners. Mr. Cameron said the unexpected surcharge is completely unacceptable. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
It was a somber day in Canada Thursday, the day after a lone gunman killed a soldier standing guard at Canada's National War Memorial before firing shots and running into Parliament in the capital, Ottawa. Crowds gathered at the war memorial to honor Corporal Nathan Cirillo. Police have identified the gunman as 32-year-old Michael Zahaf Bebou, Canadian-born and might have held Libyan citizenship as well. Some Ottawa residents, like Cher Scott, were angry about the attack.
The young man that died did nothing. He did nothing to deserve what he got, and I am so angry at the man that shot him.
The heart of Ottawa had been in lockdown after Wednesday's attack, with fears that other gunmen might be on the loose. Police now believe the gunman acted alone. He was in Ottawa applying for a passport to travel to Syria, according to Canadian Police Commissioner Bob Paulson. Jack Harris, a Canadian member of Parliament, said security in Ottawa will change in the aftermath of the attack.
Obviously, it was a vulnerability that this individual was able to penetrate. Clearly, that's not going to be allowed to happen again. So, there will be a massive, major review by all relevant forces and officials, and we would expect that certain changes would be made.
Members of Parliament Thursday honored 58-year-old Sergeant-at-Arms Kevin Vickers, who confronted and shot the gunman just outside the parliamentary caucus rooms. Prime Minister Stephen Harper paid tribute to those who made sacrifices for the well-being of others.
We are so fortunate to have people like this. The past couple of decades has, you know, we see across the world increasing places where the planet is descending into savagery, and there are people who every day of their lives stand on guard for this country and for all of us, and we obviously want to convey our gratitude to these two servicemen and their families, but also to all the people who undertake this extremely dangerous work on behalf of the world.
Prime Minister Harper went on to say that Wednesday's incident will not take Canadians to their knees.
We'll be vigilant, but we will not run scared. We will be prudent, but we will not panic. And as for the business of government, well, here we are in our seats, in our chamber, in the very heart of our democracy and our work.
Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper speaking Thursday before members of Parliament. Growing numbers of swimmers are trading the comfort of the pool for a workout in open water. They're known as wild swimmers. It seems an appropriate description when you consider that they dive into lakes, rivers, and oceans almost any time of the year. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from the northwestern port city of Seattle on how the rising popularity of open water swimming is reflected in races and an unusual new business.
Sure, you'll see people taking a quick dip at Seattle's Alki Beach at the height of summer, but this is October. The salt water of Puget Sound is 13 degrees Celsius, and the air not much warmer. Hence the involuntary sound effects at the beginning of a group swim. The first one into the water is a 43-year-old tech worker from suburban Seattle, Mike Tanner.
You know, I usually swim from about May until end of November in open the water, and then I go back to the pool again and wait for May again.
And so most people would probably go to Mexico or Hawaii at this time of year, right?
I'm not very bright, and it's a bit of a challenge, and I get bored in a pool.
This day, Tanner is a paying customer on an escorted swim excursion. More than a dozen swimmers, almost all in wetsuits, trail behind an orange kayak for a 1.5-kilometer saltwater swim. Trip leader Gila Muir paddles the first of the support boats.
A swim excursion is not a race. That's the primary differentiation. It's an expedition, it's an adventure.
Muir has turned the concept into a business called Say Yes to Life Swims. She took up swimming in her mid-40s. The Seattle entrepreneur soon recognized there were enough other converts around to support a new business.
Why pay to swim when you can just go down and jump in yourself? It's for the camaraderie, as you can see, the incredible enthusiasm, the feeling of support.
Muir spoke by a beach bonfire where her clients warmed themselves post-swim with hot chocolate and fish and chips. The founding of her business 3 years ago underscores the growing interest in open water swimming in this region. Kelly Reynolds of Seattle is one of the newest converts.
I'm like a couple years out of swimming in college, and I don't want to race in pools anymore because I don't want to see how slow I am. So I want to start doing more open water stuff.
Her verdict after her first swim in Puget Sound?
It was cold, but it wasn't that bad. I thought it was going to be worse.
Another place to observe growth is on the entry sheets of open water swim races and events around the nation. One of the bigger ones is the Long Bridge Swim at Sandpoint, Idaho. Founder Eric Ridgway says the nearly 3-kilometer swim across Lake Pend'Oreille drew 68 participants when he started it in 1995. This year, more than 700 registered. Ridgway says a little more than half wear wetsuits.
I would encourage people to consider a wetsuit because it makes them a little bit safer. It gives them buoyancy, should make them a little bit faster, and will keep their body temperature up and less chance of hypothermia.
Ridgway gives some credit to triathlons for introducing newcomers to open water swimming, that along with society's broader interest in fitness. Another event to witness big growth off a small base is the Portland, Oregon Bridge Swim, now in its fourth year. Nearly 100 people registered to swim either a relay segment or the full 17 kilometers with the current down the Willamette River this July. Across the Pacific, the New Zealand Ocean Swim Series gets underway in November, and there are dozens of events across Europe where it's much colder. Spain inaugurates its Swim the World competition in the waters off Cadiz. Lancashire, England hosts the annual Fireworks 500 night swim in a big water-filled former quarry. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can re-listen to our show again if you want to. I'm Susan Yockey. See you next week. This is Washington signing off.